podcast featuring views and interviews on genre fiction in the Australasian region. I'm your host, Sean Wright, and welcome to episode 2. You may note the format has changed to a single interview. This is to enable faster production turnaround and combat time pressures brought about by my new job. So sit back and relax. This episode features Jody Cleghorn, author, editor, and co-founder of Emergent Publishing. Welcome to the podcast, Jody.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
It's a pleasure. Now, I'm going to launch straight into it. You first came to my attention with your editing and publishing work through the press you co-founded called Emergent Publishing. Now, for our listeners that don't know your background, can you tell us a bit about your work achievements since returning to writing in 2008?
The interesting thing, Sean, when I was considering work achievements is that writing, editing and publishing have kind of run the gauntlet side by side since 2008. So the short of it is that I've edited over 300 short stories. We have published 10 anthologies through Emergent Publishing's 3 imprints, and 6 of those have been original native anthologies to the publishing house. And also in that time, I guess I've made my first professional sale as an author, had a chance to network and connect in with a whole bunch of really, really awesome people. And I guess going right back to 2008, actually establishing Emergent Publishing from the get-up.
So that's not insignificant. I was aware of some of the things that you were doing, but when you put it like that, that's significant. And yeah, it's just, I sort of think that maybe I should have cottoned on to what you were doing a little bit earlier, but I've only been doing this for 2 years, so I'm definitely going to have fun going back through some of your previous publications, some of your work as an editor, digging around the internet to find more stuff on you. I came across the site Write Anything, which you credited with the beginning of your professional growth, and you stated in a post that you'd just done recently that on returning to writing, the internet had changed everything. And I was wondering, what was the biggest change or obstacle, and how did you overcome it?
I guess for me, the internet opened doors to meet other writers. When I look back, I've been writing since 1984, since I was 10 years old, and writing stories about Willy the Koala at the LA Olympics were the first stories I ever penned. But I always wrote in isolation. I didn't know any other writers. None of my friends at high school wrote. No one that I met in my early 20s wrote. So even though I had, chosen the career path of a writer by, having a string of really bad hospitality jobs and childcare jobs and whatnot, I don't think I'd ever actually met anyone else who wrote. So in 2007, I think it was late 2007, someone that I knew through an astrology forum of all bizarre things had a blog, and I noticed that she was doing this thing called Fiction Friday, and she was writing these little short fiction pieces, which led me to Write Anything. And suddenly I realised there was this whole world of writing on the internet, writing prompts, writing information, and all these amazing other sort of very new, very raw writers. So the biggest change for me was to actually meet other people who were also writing and interested in the same things that I was interested in. And I guess that changes everything, because there's an added impetus to keep writing, to keep connected in with those people. And I guess through working and writing short fiction for the Fiction Friday prompts, first time ever I understood my process. So even though I'd done creative writing workshops and other bits and pieces through TAFE, I didn't actually understand that I needed kind of this external prompt to kind of kick off my writing. So that changed everything for me in knowing how I could spark off a story. I can remember at TAFE, they told us to for homework to go home and write 20, potential stories. And I was just like, what? I don't know. so knowing that I could take an external prompt and just sit with it long enough and that the story would come, that completely changed the way I wrote. The problem with the internet is the immediacy of it. So for the first time ever, people were coming and reading my work. Well, I always had high school mates that would read the crap that I was writing and be into it and keep me writing. But for the first time, people who didn't know me were coming to read my writing. And so it becomes really addictive because as a writer, you want affirmation. And the best kind of affirmation is someone coming to your blog and leaving a comment going, I really liked your story. So I found that for the first 2 years I was writing, all I was doing was churning out first draft stories, sticking them on my blog, you know, belonging to different writing communities and getting people to come and comment on my work. So, of course, what it gives you a false kind of sense of achievement in a way. So I wasn't working at honing that first draft into something else, something amazing, something awesome, and sending it out to somewhere else to have it published and reaching a wider audience. And as much as I love the internet and I love what it's done for writing, part of me is a little leery of that false sense of achievement that the internet and writing online writing communities can give you. I think they're a great place to start off, especially to connect with other people and get your writing moving. But I think that they can stifle you as well, that you need to see it as a stepping point to going somewhere else. So I'm really lucky in as much as a lot of those people that I was originally writing with, which includes Paul Anderson, who went on to be my business partner, a lot of those people are still writing and we've kind of grown with each other over the years and seen each other have some publishing success. But I think it was all of us stepping out of that comfort zone and going beyond. So really lucky. I had this great mate, Dan Powell, who lives in Germany, and he was always putting his work out there, getting published in literary journals and all this kind of stuff. And he was kind of like my mentor hero. And I wanted to just follow in his footsteps. So he and I have been critiquing partners sort of on and off now for, I guess, 3.5-4 years. And it was him putting his work out there that kind of kicked me up the bum to start putting my work out there.
I was just thinking then, as you were relating your story, I did my first fiction writing since 1990 this year. And I found it very helpful to have not only a group of, like a writing group, but to also have a workshop as well, because there's, you know, once I'd finished the one story and I thought, gee, I've been through that 3 times, I've polished it off. And then you come and have, you know, like 10 different people take your story apart and go, you know, this would fit in better here. And it just really shows you, I suppose, how much better your story can be. So I can understand where you're coming from, definitely. Well, you're well known and respected for your work in coordinating charity publications and for helping to grow new writers. And I wondered how that impacted, and that can be impacted in any way, your own writing.
This is the squirmy one where I wanted to take the fifth. It would be easy to say that for every moment or every minute that I've put into a charity anthology or invested in someone else's work or someone else's career is a minute that hasn't gone into mine. But that's kind of erroneous. There's positive effects and there's negative effects. And I guess for a long time I focused a little bit too much on the negative effects because it was really hard, especially around 100 Stories for Queensland time, where sort of the core group of people who had helped through getting it out there, getting the stories read, getting them picked, they kind of moved on. So while I was kind of wading through additional edits and trying to pull the rest of it all together and get it to print, they're out there releasing books and making sales and making money. And I remember at the time just going, this sucks. Mills down my neck and I just want to get out. And it was easy for me to see what was taking away from writing. And I guess for a long time I conceptualized it as this battle between editing and writing, where writing becomes victimized. And after I had two really bad bouts of depression in 2011 and literally completely fell apart in November, I sort of picked myself back up and went, I need to rethink this a whole heap better. So what I did was I sat down and I wrote a list of all the things that writing had given to editing, that editing had given to writing, and that the battle ended here. It was time that the two needed to actually get along with each other. And so seeing what each of them had given to each other sort of helped me make peace with that. And I guess at some point you have to let go of your addiction to helping other people and wanting to grow and provide opportunities for other people, and sort of spin it around and invest that time back into you. So I'm very grateful for 5 years of editing and all those stories that I've produced, and been lucky enough to give dozens of authors their debut publication, and for a lot of them the chance to work with a professional editor for the first time. That even though I haven't done as much writing as I would have liked to, that I think my writing improved very, very quickly. Spending time working in other people's work, which is why I keep telling people the best investment you will ever make in your own writing is beta reading for other people, because you very quickly learn what makes a story tick, and you can apply that to your own work. So I think, despite the fact that I don't have, as big a back catalogue of stories or work as I might have liked after 5 years, I think the improvement trajectory really lends itself to the time that I've spent working with other people.
You gave me the opportunity to read some of your work that has been published, including some yet to be released stuff that we're going to talk about a little bit later on in the podcast. And I was just going to say, of all the work, there's well, I felt the work that you've just released is quite frankly brilliant, and hope I'm not making you blush, but even some of the earlier stuff, it was quality work. So I think if that's the way you've approached it, I think you're right. I think that that has been a good investment in your writing. We sort of answered a question there in your answer before, so I'll skip on to the next one, which was you were apparently well known for saying that you don't write science fiction, and if I'm correct, I think it was your partner described your work as dark, weird shit. What do you write, and what do you think influences that fiction?
I think, first of all, I'll go back and deconstruct the I don't write science fiction, because I think a lot of people go, yes, you do. I think what happened was I always wrote contemporary fiction or dark contemporary fiction. And then my son was born 8.5 years ago, and my whole worldview changed. So I found what I was writing was science fiction, but I didn't realize what I was writing was science fiction. And then I had that moment where I went to a Sunny Whitelaw world building workshop. Like, the penny hasn't even dropped then that I was going to a world building workshop. And she took my friend and I aside, and she said, "Of all the people here, you're the only people actually writing science fiction." I'm like, huh? Okay. I guess I conceptualized science fiction as one thing, and I didn't see that my writing was fitting in with that. But I absolutely embrace science fiction and, more broadly, I guess, speculative fiction, and the fact that it is a bit dark and it is a bit weird and it does twist occasionally with people's minds. And the dark leadership came up from a couple of years ago. We went to Dave's Christmas party, and one of his workmates said, "Oh, you write, what do you write?" And of course, I had that moment where my mouth just hung open, because it was so hard to kind of bring it all together under one umbrella. And Dave just turned around and went, "Oh, she writes dark weird shit." And it stuck. Because I write a bit of contemporary fiction and I write some science fiction, and I've been, more recently writing some horror, but I've also written vignettes this year and haiku, and I've written some short scripts as well. So kind of dark weird shit, kind of it just kind of grabs people. They kind of understand sort of immediately what it is, and then they sort of say, "And what else?" Give us a little bit more. So I guess I'm interested in the dark vein of humanity, but I also, I guess I'm a conceptual writer, and I think anyone who knows my editing and publishing work can see I'm really drawn to a concept and to see, you know, how far I can push boundaries of things, and that's definitely flowed on into my writing. So I was thinking, Cocaine, My Sweetheart, which is in 89. I got the story, but I knew that I wanted to tell a time travel story, but I wanted to see if I could do it backwards because, you know, set myself up these crazy challenges almost, and then see if I can actually do it. And with Indigo, which is in From Stage Door Shadows, I had the line about Blue Jean and Baby. And then I think about a week later, The Living End released. The ending is just the beginning repeating. And so, of course, I went, oh, I wonder if you can write a story where the ending is just the beginning repeating without it actually being a story that comes in full circles, that still has some kind of forward momentum. But if I look at it from a thematic point of view, if you look at across my body of work, I guess there's things that are always repeating within it, and that's ideas of love and loss, of power imbalances, of time travel, of, you know, the eternal question, you know, what if? And especially in my science fiction stuff, I'm sort of drawn to medical technology, especially that intersection between medical innovation and humanity and what it can actually mean to be human, which I guess you see a little in Firefly. It's more evident in Blinding, which is in the Hope anthology. But I studied some medical anthropology at university, so that kind of has definitely influenced the science fiction that I write, and it will be very, very pronounced in the collection of novellas that I've just started writing this year. So, yeah, but music is an absolute influence, dreams, and just everyday life. There's nothing like just walking down the street and seeing, you know, a man in a bright pink shirt running across the road and almost being hit carrying a cardboard box. And the first thing is like, why is he doing that? Dave was saying to me, it was in a Virginia Woolf novel, how there's a character in there and he's a writer, and he said it's like this odd dislocation with the world, of seeing the world and thinking of it in a different way. So I guess just participating in everyday life is an influence.
You got me thinking about that, particularly Indigo, because I read it this morning, about you're talking about being a conceptual writer. And what I wanted to sort of point out to listeners, I won't tell them about the story because it's one of I think all your stories have a certain, you can't really spoil them too much because the story will unravel for you. You've sort of got to wait for things to hit you. So when I was reading that, and also when I was reading Firefly Epilogue, I didn't get a sense of where the story was going. So you know how sometimes you can read something and go, oh, I know exactly what she's going to do with this story. I know exactly, yeah, you know, the concept she's working on. And in Firefly Epilogue in particular, I just thought, this story's going one way. Oh, I quite like the writing, quite like the character. And then bang, it's tidied up nicely at the end. And if I go back through it again, I can see where you've peppered all the way through the story these wonderful little sort of flags that are pointing the way, but are hidden at the same time. So I wanted to say that I think the writing in that sense comes across very, very polished and very a pleasure to read, and then a pleasure to go back and analyze once you've read it, if you get what I mean.
Oh, that's my year. Actually, you've made my entire 5-year career.
Oh, it's a power that I have, apparently.
Well, maybe it was in one of the emails. So I spent so much time building, you know, one side of my professional life in editing and publishing that in a lot of ways writing has kind of taken a backseat to that. So I don't get a chance. I haven't in the past had a chance very often to talk about writing or to actually get feedback on my own writing. And I've got a lovely friend, Jen Brubasher, who is a Canadian living in London, and the few interviews or anything that I've spoken about my own writing, I always get messages from her saying, I love hearing about you talking about your writing. It can be easy to forget in amongst all this other stuff that, you know, I'm a writer as well, and that's what drew me originally into publishing and editing. So it's really nice, Sean, to get some feedback about my writing, especially from somebody like you.
No, that's all right. And what for the listeners who are going, oh, what are these stories? What's it all about? I'll include some links at the end of the show notes on the podcast, because, yeah, I think it's important for Australian readers and certainly for world readers to have a look at what you're doing, because I think you have got a really competent grasp of the craft, and I sort of look at you and go, I hope I could write fiction like that in 4 or 5 years' time. So now I wanted to talk a bit more about your work that is coming out. Well, actually, Eliora's the novella, which is out now for free, I understand, if you can get to the bookie.sh site. So that's you've released two speculative fiction works. Your novella, Eliora, featured in the Australian Review of Fiction Special Edition, and you've got a short story that's going to be included in Fablecroft's One Small Step anthology. I've read both of them, and like I said, I think they display a really mature grasp of the craft. And you sort of indicated before that you're planning a group of novellas or a collection of novellas. Do you want to talk about those, and then we'll launch into talking about Firefly, Epilogue, and Eliora?
Absolutely. I guess 2009, I participated in this nutty thing called Fourth Fiction, which was touted as reality TV for writers that was run online. And anyone who was a writer was able to, and was interested, was able to kind of write in parallel with what was actually going on the official website and the rest of it. Like, oh, I have a crack at this. Like the concept. And so each of them was a challenge across, I think it was 12 weeks. And I had this story idea about a midwife hearing two heartbeats. I guess for the listeners, my background is in home birth. And so even though I'd done a lot of writing, I had kind of shied away from the birth aspect of it. I guess I needed to hone my craft before I kind of knew how to sort of inject the true passion of my interests into some work. And so I wrote, as I discovered last night, 21,000 words of this kind of novella, which I've termed birth punk, which a lot of female spec fic writers really excited at this idea of this thing called birth punk. I joined the Australian Writer's Marketplace online, their novel of the year, and sort of had the intention of writing this birth punk novel based on these characters, and kind of started to flesh it all out. And of course then Eliora came along and kind of just sucked up the rest of the year. I think about 6 weeks ago I realized that for me the idea of writing a novel is absolutely daunting. As someone who only writes short fiction, Eliora is the longest thing I've ever written. I think it comes in just under 30,000 words. But the longest thing I had written prior to Eliora was 8,000 words, which was the story that I penned for the Hope anthology. So the idea of writing kind of 100,000 or 100,000 words or 120,000 words, you know, it was absolutely terrifying. And then when I looked at the complexity of what I was trying to achieve, I wasn't entirely sure how I was going to take these five characters and their narrative arcs and wind them all into one novel length thing. And I went, oh, I really like this novella kind of length. What if I group them all up? And not only that, bouncing off, I guess, the Chinese Whisperings idea of interconnected short stories, what if I wrote these five, which has now become six, novellas, but wrote them in a way that they interlocked with each other? So the plan now is to write these six novellas of around 30,000 words by the end of June, and sort of see what happens. I guess this is sort of my foray into, you know, a feminist tract of writing. I guess. So I think I needed some confidence under my belt to sort of tackle something this big. I'm not sure it's necessarily The Handmaiden's Tale or anything like that, but I know it's something that's really, really important to me. And so I kind of want to get it right, but I also don't want it to be very preachy or anything like that. And I've realized too that this very complex world that I'm in the process of building has all these multi-layers to it. And I think that was also what drew me to the idea of creating interlocking novellas, that each of these little sub-enclaves within this futuristic city, that they all get a chance to be displayed in their brilliance and their darkness and how they can all exist in the one place, I guess. So that's my plan for the next 6 months. I'm taking some time out from editing and publishing, finally. I've got a couple of little projects that need to be finished at the start of this year, but I'm not starting anything new publishing-wise until these six novellas are written.
Okay, well, I'll be eagerly awaiting them based on what I've had to read over the last 3 or 4 days. So that's even birth punk for myself. I'd be willing to go and read that just to find out what it's all about, because yeah, I think you've got like I said, a good handle on the craft, and it's a pleasure to read you. Your story, Firefly Epilogue, that appears in One Small Step, or will appear when it's released, I thought it was brilliant. It's a wonderful combination of character and emotion, and then it's got a nice little science fiction concept tied to it that it sort of doesn't hit you until you get right to the end, actually. It's very subtle, then bam, it hits you. Without spoiling it, what would you like to say about the story? What was your inspiration for it?
I started writing Firefly Epilogue as a piece of flash fiction in 2011. So I think I started writing it in February. I wrote it as part of a Friday Flash April Fool's Day blog swap. So silly, silly me, signed up for it, even though that I was trying to produce three anthologies at the same time. It was one of those things where I kept making sure I was giving myself opportunities to write. So we were matched up in pairs, and the idea was that we would swap stories and they would appear on other people, your partner's blog, as an April Fool's Day type thing. So I was paired up with this lovely, lovely American lady called Kate, and we were given a prompt which was insect repellent. And of course, the first thing I thought of when I thought of insect repellent was our trip down the Kuala Selangor River in Malaysia and being doused in this horrendous stuff that I was sure had DDT in it, because it was bought from a Malaysian pharmacy with no English on the bottle. And the fireflies. And so I sort of emailed Kate and said, this is the idea I have for mine. And she said, oh, we've got fireflies all along the river where I live. That's great. You know, let's see if we can take insect repellent and wind the firefly angle into it as well. So I've actually got a picture of me in Borders working on Firefly Epilogue. And it was one of those stories that just didn't want to be flash fiction. And I was getting to about 1,300 words and realising the story was much bigger, and what was I going to do? And then there was all the pressure coming externally from the projects that I was involved in, and I could just feel myself going under. And I wrote to Kate and said, look, I'm really not coping. I'm not sure if I can actually do this. And she said, look, my mum's really, really sick. I don't think I can do it either. And so we kind of kept contact with each other when she went to visit her mum, and then her mum fell gravely ill, and her mum passed away in the middle of that year. And I think Kate's influence and Franny's death absolutely impacted kind of the kink that the story took. I think the original idea, and I won't spoil it, for the science fiction angle was always, always there. But I think being involved with Kate and through her period of grieving perhaps tempered the emotional intensity in the story. And, you know, the shallow part of me goes, it really was just a poke at Eat, Pray, Love. Of this middle, you know, this middle class white woman who goes to find herself, and her publisher pays for her to go and eat and, you know, and pray and love. And in the end, she just finds a man and gets married. It didn't seem to me. So I guess it was all those things kind of winding together. And when those two characters kind of got in the boat together, it was just kind of like sitting in the back of the boat and just listening to the two of them and just scribing it all down. I think there's a bit in it where she says, you know, just me. I'm not putting up with these loudmouth people who are going to ruin the experience for me, because we were on a flat bottom boat with all bunches and bunches of tourists who did not shut up the entire trip. I just wanted to, could you just be quiet? And sort of through writing the Firefly epilogue, it was a really good chance to kind of go back there, but do it the way I wanted to do it. I think the other thing too is when I was talking earlier about the intersection between medical advancement and humanity, kind of that idea of, well, what happens if you have this amazing medical find, but it makes you question everything that you know about something that is so integral to life that it freaks everybody out, so they just bury it rather than embrace it and stand up and say, we will deal with the moral and ethical implications of this so perhaps people can have a better life. And I guess it was that kind of idea that Australians kind of go overseas with all these grand ideas and can often be quashed within an institutional environment, within a university or a research facility, because what they're what they're researching and that kind of bullshit out their nature doesn't fit within a preconceived idea of how we do things. I guess I've got that idea of, you know, Australians being willing to push the buck a little bit further than perhaps, you know, somewhere like America might be happy with. And so sort of that's where his character kind of came from. And that whole idea that, you know, he was on the river trying to find himself too. So, you know, it was kind of destined that they were to row up and down the river together.
It's really, like, you've just exposed to me a couple of other things within that story that I didn't perhaps pick up the first time through. So I think, no, it's a good story. And I think, well, obviously, Tahani Wesley at Fablecroft thought it was good. And I think well worth picking up that publication when it comes out. Probably not just for your story alone, but for all the stories that Tahani will bring together. But if they're all approaching sort of depths that Firefly epilogue goes into and presents, so I think that'll be a must buy for myself.
At that moment when the table of contents was released and just went, I'm with who? Because some of my all-time favourite Australian authors, female authors, are in that anthology. So I'm having that fangirl moment of going, my goodness me, my story is good enough to sit in here alongside these wonderful women. So it's going to be good.
I wanted to talk about the novella Eliora.
Yep.
Which I hope I'm pronouncing right. Is that close?
It's got the hard L at the start.
Okay, then. All right, so it was released as part of this Rabbit Hole special put out by the Australian Review of Fiction. And I just wondered, before we get to talk about it, can we talk a bit about the Rabbit Hole process for our listeners that didn't or don't know about that?
Absolutely. The Rabbit Hole is like NaNoWriMo on speed. So it's to write 30,000 words in 3 days. And it's the brainchild of former CEO of the Queensland Writers' Centre, Kate Eltham, who basically found herself with a book to finish and a deadline and no real time in her everyday life to finish it. So she set up the Rabbit Hole, I think 2 years ago it was, as this intense writing experience, and to get 30,000 words down, or as many as you could. So I'd been watching it forever and it never fitted in with what was going on in my life. And then finally in June last year, finally everything kind of lined up. So it was the rabbit hole that ran in conjunction with the Emerging Writers Centre and sponsored by the QWC. And for the first time ever, it was held in four locations. So we had a team here in Brisbane with Peter Ball as our captain. And there was a team down in Melbourne with Jason Narung at the helm of it. Then a team down in Tassie. I can't think of who was the team captain in Tassie. And then Patrick Duffy had the online team. So I think there were 80 of us all writing with and against each other. So we went in Queensland, in Brisbane, we went in on the Friday night and wrote for a couple of hours and then rocked up to do it across 20 hours, the Saturday and the Sunday. Saturday morning, Peter came in and basically said that the Review of Australian Fiction was interested in short stories or novellas that had come out of the rabbit hole. And immediately I went, oh, I've got that story that just doesn't want to be a short story. So I had prepared by sort of making a list of everything that I could possibly write during that time, and El Yule was on that list. And as soon as Peter said novella, I went, that's it, El Yule needs to be a novella. So I sat there and I think I originally had 5,200 words, and it was written while I was struggling with Indigo in 2011. So basically, yeah, there was a bunch of us. We sat and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And that was what the rabbit hole was. And Matthew Lamb was good enough to open a special edition of the Review of Australian Fiction. And El Yule is in there as the novella. And there's five other fantastic short stories that are in there too. And was also wonderful enough to provide us with the editorial services of Leslie Holm, who is the editorial assistant at Island Magazine in Tasmania. So it was just, you know, you rock up one of these things and, you know, hope that you've got some words. I never, ever imagined in 1,000 years that I'd actually get a publication out of it.
It's a good good novella. I was I wasn't surprised because I'd read Firefly Epilogue before I'd come along to read it. But obviously, being through that process, it's polished and it's a bit hard hitting in places. I was going to say I read an article by Dr. Lisa Hannett yesterday. She's got a new column out in This Is Horror, which is a UK site. And her article was called Wide Open Fear, and she talked about this sort of recent or current trend of Australian Gothic. And she went through a number of people, like you've just mentioned, Jason Narung was mentioned, his partner, Kirsten McDermott. I'm just trying to think who else was mentioned, but it was all about the Australian landscape and how that contributes to a certain Australian type of horror. And I wanted to give you a chance to, well, sell El Yule to the listeners on the podcast. Not that you have to sell it, because I think you can get it free still from the boogie.sh site. But if you had a pitch to a reader, what would you say? And then after that, can we go into what influenced the story?
I'm getting the Jack Dan 30-second pitch from Conflux. Last year. I think Australians are so enamoured with that whole idea of the road trip, and not just the Wolf Creek idea of road trip. And I guess this is, you know, this is one way a road trip can go pear-shaped. I don't know. For me, I find it really hard to kind of condense El Yule into a sales pitch, because there's so many complexities in it, and I'm never quite sure what I can say without giving anything away within it. But I guess I realised, I think on about fifth rewrite, at the heart of it really was, you know, what monster are you creating today that the way all these characters interact with each other all have a very powerful and potent and often dark impact upon each other in this little town that doesn't appear on a map. Yeah. Bad souls, bitch.
No, I can understand where you're coming from, because it's to describe it perhaps as how I could say, well, it's like this or it's like that, doesn't really do it justice. It's I think it'll appeal to a wide audience. Anyone in Australia who's been on a road trip, and I think that's probably a lot of people in Australia, considering we all live so far away from one another and we all like to drive. But it's where I live out here in rural South Australia, within about 10 kilometres of where I am, there'd be 10 ruined homesteads. So, yeah, it was very easy for me to get a feeling, a sense of what you were writing about.
And Eluru is actually a homestead town. So you've absolutely nailed it. Excellent. I'm glad that that's easily picked up.
We're sort of talking around what the story is, but I think you're right. I think you can't really say too much, because it'll give the story away. But it's Australian Gothic horror. It's very subtle to begin with, I think, and then gets progressively
more impactful.
Yeah, but I would put it up there with any of the recent Australian horror I've read. So if people like Kester McDermott's work, I think there'd be certain crossover between the readership there, and there's a certain because she sort of writes inner city Gothic, Australian Gothic, and if you've read any of Jason Arung's stuff, he's more a boy from the bush, so it's got that Australian country meets city feel to it, and that experience you have when city people drive through the country, I think. So hopefully we've sold it enough, even though we don't have to. Go out and read it, people. You don't even have to buy it. What did influence Eluru?
Most recently, if I sort of work back from the influence, you talked about Jason and Kirsten, and I read Selvage just after I'd written the first draft of this, and I read Madigan Mine while I was caught and floundering and dying in about the fifth rewrite. So they both had an absolute impact and influence on what I was writing. And I know, having finished Madigan Mine, it was almost like something switched on in my head and I was able to write again. So thank you, Kirsten. But if I go back further, the very original idea came from a dream that I had in August 2011. And I believe in a red notebook somewhere I have some original notes. And it was basically about a very, very creepy house that was in the middle of nowhere, that was absolutely beautiful on the bottom floor, and then had these additional stories built onto it that were just an abomination. And why did this house exist in this field in the middle of nowhere? And then there was the song in the river, the hypnotic song. And I spent most of writing, well, actually, I'll be honest, it was never a first draft because of the nutty deadlines to get it finished and get it in, because I guess Matthew Lamb was counting on people sending in short stories. I was trying to write a novella at the same time, in the same timing that other people were writing short stories. So I had a very tight schedule, and I needed to have it beta read and rewritten before I wanted to submit it. So I actually submitted it to my beta readers in two parts. And ironically, it reads very much like a novella in two parts, with that creepy dream sequence kind of segueing one into the other. So there was no first draft, and through most of the second rewrite, I had no idea about what was in the river. I kept asking everyone if they could tell me of some monster or this or that that I could put in the river. And I kept turning up a blank. And then I was doing some research, and I can't even remember what it was on. And I came across, I'm not going to say what it is, and it went in the river. And once I realized what was in the river, it completely changed the character of Eleanor. It completely changed where she came from. And it really gave, it gave a really solid foundation for the backstory, I guess, of where the characters of Joe and Hal and Benny end up, and in turn fleshed out the character of, you know, Matthew and Gus. And it, it seemed to be the last thing that was missing. And once I dropped it in, it all just made perfect sense. But I was really, really lucky as I was doing the second rewrite. I realised once I knew how it ended that I needed these little markers that would kind of, it would dawn on Joe that something wasn't right, and it would give her a hole back into the past that she had forgotten. And because I was writing to such a really nutty deadline, I basically went onto Facebook and said, right, I'm writing this novella called Alura. It's about three band members who turn off the road and discover themselves in this small country town off the map that looks like it has been lost in time and or stuck in time. I need something on the dashboard of the car. It can be anything that you want. It's this busted up old brown Tarago. And it went ballistic. I had 40 odd people come in and start offering up things. And that's where we get the bobblehead Jesus. And if people go to my website and plug in Alura, you'll actually see a picture of the bobblehead Jesus. There was the Kiss Snow Dome, and hanging around in eBay, I actually found a Kiss Snow Dome. it's gone. Someone actually bought it. The V-dub medallion that hangs, which was perfect because once I worked out that Eleanor was German, worked out that she would actually recognise the VW medallion as well. And then when I thought all the fun was over, I then needed a tattoo for Hal. So I went back and said, right, I've got this character. His name is Hal. He's pretty cool and hip, or he thinks he's pretty cool and hip. My editor kept saying, why does he wear a beanie? It's the middle of summer. Because there is a whole subsection of young males who think that's cool. I don't get it either. And so I said, you know, this character needs a tattoo. And so not only did I get the tattoo, I also got the backstory about the, you know, it says Yakapoo, you know, that sort of stuff that you just couldn't come up with. And the Black Ops sheep also came from what ended up being called the Alura Brains Trust. So I was really, really lucky just in drawing all these people in who then started being a little cheer squad to get me over the line and get to my 27th of July deadline. And then I was lucky enough to have Dan Powell beta read it for me and sort of was able to point out all the obvious flaws in it. And it was kind of, once it got momentum, it seemed to sort itself out, and anything that I kind of needed to fill in kind of just miraculously appeared. I guess it was another more proof that if you just trust that the timing will always be right, it will always be. And believe me, I was so glad when I finally turned in the final of this, which happened at the same time as my son was speed vomiting. Ooh. So the fact that this got finished and got published, it's still, I still kind of shake my head and can't believe that that it was anywhere near as good as it became.
Maybe you should do more of those. It seems to have worked. For those listeners, because this, the podcast that we're listening to at the moment wasn't intended to just be a speculative fiction podcast, I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about your collaborative fiction. It's contemporary fiction that you write with, is it Adam Byatt? And it's called Postmarked Piper's Reach. It, I just started reading it this morning and it sounds fascinating. Could you enlighten our readers, or listeners rather, as to what Postmarked Piper's Reach is?
Postmarked Piper's Reach was an incredibly selfish project. And buy it into at the start of last year. I think I said earlier that in 2011, I suffered some pretty intense periods of depression and, you know, a complete breakdown. When I came traveling back from Melbourne to Brisbane, which ironically was when I discovered that the Hume Highway was not going to be where Alura was the most tallest road in history, I met Adam on New Year's Eve 2011, and we'd known each other and we'd worked together on different projects, but that was the first time we met in person, and it was kind of like we'd just known each other forever and probably could have just lived across the fence from each other. And I'd had this idea of a collaborative fictional letter writing project. I'd been kicking around my head for years, but I'd never found the right person to write it with. And as soon as I met Adam in person, I went, he's the one, absolutely. So I sent him a text message and just sort of said, oh, did you write letters when you were a teenager? And he went, oh, it's prolific. I'm like, excellent, tick another box. And less than a week later, they were on holidays up at Brunswick Heads. I went down and I sort of texted him in advance and said, look, I've got this idea that I'd like to pitch to you. And so our kids were playing in the water and we jokingly called it the bikini pitch. It'll be the first and only time I ever pitched an idea in a bikini, and said, look, I have this idea for this letter writing project, yada, yada, what do you think? And he went, absolutely, I'm so in. Where do we start? And the selfish side of it was that I needed something to get me excited about writing again. And I was so vulnerable and I was so had no confidence in my abilities that I needed to do it with someone else. And I needed to do it in a format that I felt really comfortable in. And I had no idea. I probably wrote, you know, 500,000 words as a teenager. And it didn't require any intense collaboration, because we've got what's called the no spoilers policy, where I don't know what's in any letter until it arrives. And the same for Adam. It's all first draft material, so what gets written on the page is what appears on the website. And, you know, the underlying of was I wanted to write letters again. And so I think we've got about 55,000 words attached to the project at the moment, and they're all handwritten. So I write a letter from, you know, Ella Louise Wilson, who is my character, to Adam, to his character, Jude Smith. So I write it on paper, put it in an envelope and send it. And then you've got to wait 2 days for it to arrive. The longest 2 days in history, especially if Adam sent it for work through the post that day, because it's 3 days then. Sometimes you don't know and a letter just arrives from the blue. So we did it as some fun between us, and we decided that, oh, look, we'll put it up on the website. We'll put it up on a website as well, and we'll, you know, see if we can hook into the Tuesday Serial community. And if someone reads it, couldn't find, oh, my God, we've got posties, which are these nasty fans, including one great guy, Russ, who I've worked with in other things, who comes and gives a dissertation. There is something in this idea of the person who got away, which is really what underlies Ella Louise and Jude's friendship, relationship or twisted, whatever they've got 20 years later. You know, that. And what if that person who got away came back into your life 20 years later? I think the catchphrase is, oh, if I grab the postcard, when the past reaches into the future, is it worth risking a second chance? And so that's what we've been exploring for the last year. And it's got enough momentum now to actually go, right, we could probably actually do something with this. So we're looking at packaging it up and seeing if someone like Momentum or Escape are interested in it. And we've spent the last year saying to people, it's not romance. We're not writing romance. Not that I've got anything against romance or anything like that. I said, if anything, we're writing womance, because there is nothing happy between these two. And it's fun. I think every writer should have something that's their writer's candy, something that they do just for the fun of it. And if you can do it with somebody else who also wants to do it just for the fun of it, you know, even better. Been really blessed, because starting Postmark Piper's Reach at the start of last year started everything else off. So the first piece of brand new fiction I wrote, a little piece called what I left to forget was actually a backstory of Ella Louise. And then, yeah, I just wrote more and wrote more. Last year was the year of falling in love with writing again, and I think I achieved my goal.
It's a really, I thought it was a really great concept, and I've only read the first three or four letters, and it's good that, and it's interesting to listen to you talk about it, but it's good just to get those two people talking and letting the story unravel.
Yeah.
I was going to say you're up to your second season, and you did a Christmas special for it as well, didn't you?
We've done season one and season two, which is just crazy because we just intended to write some. So yeah, we got season one, season two. We've just done a Christmas special, and we've just started season three. And I laughed when Adam said, "Oh, there's absolutely a season three." And I'm like, "Where? Okay. Oh yes, I can see the season three." So I think we'll possibly go for four seasons, and with that concept of, you know, there's four seasons in a year, and in a year of these guys' lives. So I think the thing with it is it's okay voyeurism. It's a narrative told from one person to another, but the whole world can read it. And I think there's something kind of intriguing and perhaps a little bit addictive of having a chance to peer into somebody else's life when you know you're not really meant to be privy.
And I was going to say the thing that I really liked about it was that you could choose to read the text on the WordPress site, or you could have a look at the actual letters that were written. So it introduces this, I suppose, a tangible aspect to it as well, like you're discovering old letters written between two people.
Absolutely. And I think because a lot of the music that we reference is Australian too, if there's music mentioned in the letter, we've put a YouTube clip down the bottom, because music's got a very strong influence, especially in those early letters. All the stuff that Ella Louise can't say, she says to Jude through the songs and the lyrics that she shares with him. And a lot of their history as teenagers is around shared music and how that develops through their friendship as teenagers and then further on into their difficult relationships as adults. And in true me style, it went down such a dark alleyway. Adam generally writes really kind of positive, upbeat, contemporary stuff. He has an absolutely beautiful writing style with metaphors and imagery and all of this, and there's just this dark, twisted, broken character just spewing her guts out on stage. And Adam used to say to me, "No, there's a beautifulness in Ella Louise's brokenness." I'm like, I'm actually looking forward to there being some light and some beauty again in Ella Louise's life. And if I'm absolutely honest, putting Ella Louise back together was really kind of a parallel way of me putting myself back together. So I'm a little protective of her. Don't want anyone really to break her. But we'll see what happens. Once you release a character, there's not a lot you can do.
No, that's right. Well, I was going to say, I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you, and I'm dying to actually get back and read some more of the Piper's Reach letters. So I'll let you go and look after your little boy, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, interviewing you today, and wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Sean.
And that brings us, dear listeners, to the end of the podcast. Thank you for listening. You may leave audio feedback at www.speakpipe.com/bookanaut. Check the show notes for a link, or you may leave written feedback on Facebook, the Podomatic page, or at my blog.